Now this is Channel 2, over. This is Channel 2, over. This is Channel 2, over, and a continuation of the review on Wednesday, the last week, 16th of March, 1969. This is Channel 2, over. Continuation of the review on Wednesday, the last week, on March 16th, 1969.
About the content, it seems to me you have to have you say you talk about Hester Prynne, you don't talk about Hester in general, you have to know certain passages, those passages that you have studied. Now I remember this, let me see, which one am I thinking of now, this Scarlet Letter, no? And that little Goddard article, like Bradley, a Syrian writer. Euhemania and their fear feed and augment each other until the situation culminates in a preliminary way in two scenes of shuddering terror. So now you see, he focuses on those two scenes, episodes, scenes, whatever you want to call them. And one is the scene we talked about yesterday. The corresponding scene in the case of Flora occurs the next day by the lake. Once more, think of it from the angle, from the point of view of the child. A little girl too closely watched and confined by her governess. You see, that's an assumption you have to make, you see. Governess hovers over them. Seizes an opportunity for freedom that presents itself and wanders off. Now you see, you don't know. However, you don't know this true. I mean, he doesn't assume that. I think he's got to do more than that. He takes an opportunity for freedom and wanders off, but I think James presents it as if it's contrived. And this is the part that's the duplicity of it. A little later, the governess and the housekeeper, out of breath with searching, come upon her. A half dozen words have hardly been exchanged with the governess. Terror in her voice turns suddenly on the child and demands to know where her former governess is. A woman whom the little girl knows perfectly well is dead and buried. The child's face blanches. The housekeeper utters a cry, in answer to which the governess, pointing across the lake and into the vacancy, cries out, "She's there. She's there." And the child stares at the demented woman in consternation. The latter repeats, "She's there, you little unhappy thing." There, the little girl holds fast to the housekeeper and is frozen in a convulsion of fear. She recovers herself sufficiently to cry out, "I don't know what you mean. I see nobody. I never have." And then, hiding her head in the housekeeper's skirt, she breaks out in a wail, "Take me away. Take me away from her. Not the ghost, but the governess." Now that's the break. And that's one of the, in any discussion, that's a key scene. Now, you can get it. That's the way Goddard does. You can go behind that. You can go farther than he goes. He's way at the very beginning. What is called a pre-Freudian reading. That is before the Freud was read into it. His interpretation is based on his experience. And he had a governess who was crazy. Now, he was a child, and how much he can remember of his experience as a child, see, is open question. But anyhow, that gives him his cue. And that's fine. That he takes that thesis into this thing, and it pays off. I think it's all wrong. I mean, it's James has that element of evil, of the duplicity of it is there. It is, you see, in the world in which we live, you see two people, perfectly honest people, look at each other and both are lying. I sell one of my bulls out there, you see, and I know that his mama doesn't give much milk, but I sure don't tell him that. You have a rights listed in relationships that that mounts, as that mounts, the whole process of selling, in my view, is based on that. And like Eric Fromm says, you know, you've got that marketing psychology. People talk to you as a customer, and after that, you see nothing looks the same anymore. This stove, you see, he's got on here to sell. It's a direct descendant of Ben Franklin's own stove. As far as he's concerned, at that moment, because he's selling. Well, I'd carry that train of thought. Now, you see, we're so far off from that personal day, so you see, when we're willing to sort of interpret Franklin in the autobiography as he's full of himself. Look how far away from that we are. But you've got these new categories that are so much more valid than your own, or I feel than my own, are much more valid. And I think of the individual and individualism. I think I know Emerson and Thoreau both have a much surer feeling for an individual than I have. Oh, I've compromised and, you know, come to terms with all sorts of things which sort of violate the individual. That's the terminology. I didn't tell you anything today. I just going to check these things with you. Let you get to the packages. Now, let me tell you, if you're going to consider... let me check. I had this one in mind, if you don't mind. Let me check you. This one, Randall Stewart. You know, he's one of my favorites. He's such a prince of a fella. Now, here's you, Hester. Well, now, before you get to that, let me see if I can find it. This gross and we are the victims of a palpable deception, the trick of a demonstrable pathological liar, a pitiful but dangerous person with an unhinged fancy. And he gives the example, you see, that say in the letter. The letter said one thing, pretty soon she has it saying a number of other things. Remember that? Well, now look at that. That's from his point of view. But from the Emersonian point of view, it's not that. It's not pathological. It's not lying. It's not lying. That's her perceptiveness. Now, she can be wrong. And she can be on the wrong track. But you see, Oscar Cargill can't get away with that. At all. He can't get away with that. He said it, and it's right illuminating. It opens it up. It opens up a number of passages about the governess. You'd say, well, she never tells the truth. No, she doesn't. She's 20 years old. She has no experience, no judgment. But she leans too with that old feeling for that Emersonian inquiry that is, it looks like it's just born into her. Of course, she gets it from Henry James. And he gets it from Hester. You see, he wrote a little book on Hawthorne. And he said that's where he learned to write fiction. And he said Hawthorne has that deep feeling, underlying feeling for evil. Well, he has too. I don't know whether he gets it from Hawthorne or not. But now, he doesn't have a Protestant or Puritanical view of it. He adjusts as he goes along, you see, to that psychological or Freudian view. And then it's no longer evil, it's psychology or something. You see, I can give you the terms, but I can't give you any answers. So you have to pick them up and use them for your own. You have to use them. Let me refer to the spokesman for the romantic view. and her argument carries weight with many readers. Here's a woman, handsome, voluptuous beauty, who as a young girl was talked into marrying an old man, Roger Chillingworth, and all that, you see. And if you pursue that, her view is romantic. You carry it, and then you have to, as he does, you've got no choice. The high point of the romantic side of Hester is in that scene in the forest. And the key statement, you see, is the one where she says to him, "What we did had a consecration of its own. We felt it so. We said so to each other." Now that's the high point. That's all he, Hawthorne, allows Hester off that romantic point of view. See, he won't let her go too far. Eh? But that's the high point. Are you combing your head again? I'm just looking for somebody to raise a hand. There. It's in there. Hawthorne's there. I don't know. Hawthorne is, he's cagey. He makes a statement and then he covers up. Is that a legal way of doing it? In chapter 7, is it? He has, no, that's Hester's view in the second view, another view of Hester. That's that Emersonian view. Concentrated. But look at it. It's restricted to one chapter. All the suffering and pursuing, you see, and perceptiveness that Thoreau did throughout Walden, and that the governess did in on every page. Hawthorne restricts it. Then it's somebody else's story. Now he says about Hester. Hester has been much admired and all like that. See, she's done. You see, a fight like this can be inspiriting. It's fortifying. It builds one up. But she, what does it say? She's pretty well adjusted. Well, I don't think that's, I don't think so at all. Except that Hawthorne doesn't allow her to, you know, just dominate the book. He says, Arthur is the one. She was indeed courageous and strong. Arthur is, in comparison, has seemed pitiably weak, but justice, I think, has not been done to Arthur. Arthur's situation was much more difficult than Hester's. Her conflict was external. She was integrated within herself. Now, I don't think that's even close to being correct. And she said, but you see, he's not looking at it from her point of view. Now he's looking at it from Dimmesdale. From his point of view, I guess maybe she looks like that. And she set her solidly united self resolutely against the intolerant community. A fight like this can be inspiriting. It is fortifying. It builds one up. But Arthur's fight was within himself. He was a state of civil war, not war with the outside world. The community idolized him, but he had his internal troubles, and these proved to be serious. And then psychiatrists, you see, if heroism is measured in terms of magnitude and severity of the struggle which is undergone, then Arthur must be adjudged the more heroic of the two. And his reading of it is that it's Dimmesdale's story, and it winds up there, you see, there after she relieves him, you see, in a way of all those inhibitions that have been built up for so long, and that little session in fire. There could be no salvation without that. Arthur was saved, yet as by fire, he was truly a firebrand plucked out of the burning. The confession brought about a reconciliation with God and man, with not least little Pearl, from whom there has been a complete estrangement. And he quotes, Pearl kissed his lips, his spell was broken. Hester watched wonderingly. Thou lookest far into eternity with those bright, dying eyes, she said to him. Tell me what thou seest. Now that's right intense. What Arthur saw chiefly was God's mercy. He is merciful, he said. He has proved his mercy most of all in my afflictions. Praise be his name. And you see, the thing ends. That's the ending of the story. It's not Hester's story anymore. That's the ending of the story. And that is almost a glorification of the Puritan concept. Hester looks sort of feeble, compassion. So you say, it's also on a Puritan. It's also in a Puritan, you see. The world that you get into, you see, both those strands, these articles help you get into it. That's, you see, he won't tie it up in a bundle. Hawthorne won't decide, you see. He won't decide against the Puritans. Excuse me, you see, when you read an article, you want it to come to a very definite conclusion.
Passages that are in Turn Screw and Scott Letter for, you want us to know all these different passages, you know, so that we can refer them, or are we just held responsible for the books themselves?
What? Is that what you mean?
Well, in other words, like, will we often be tested on these critical articles, or just to use them as reference if we want in answering a question?
I don't want to get you involved in memory work. But I don't hardly see how you discuss Hester or anything Hawthorne without using these articles. You'd almost have to.
Question like Cargyle to Plain Texas. In other words, for the final, it's just the straight books, and then, you know, just what we picked up from the critical articles in talking about the books.
I imagine that.
Why don't you let her write these?
I would love to have a little help.
Yeah, I'll write these.
I'll make the questions out, but I'd like to have someone to test them on.
Oh.
see how they go.
I'm just trying to, you know, help us get some idea about, you know, how we should go about studying for the final.
Yeah.
So then we won't be able to tell the final to do the article.
Yeah. That's right. You assume that you'd use all those things. You assume that you'd use those. Use all your sources, you see. Give you 15 minutes, you can bring them all in. Don't look fast, but it takes too long. I can read it now without checking on his own interpretation of it. Isn't that nice? The interpretation is just as interesting as literature. You think that's going too far? Reading these good ones. You know, you have to pick and choose. Now, this thing, Foreword, Philosophy of Composition on the Raven is pretty steep, and you've got to discount a lot of that. He's pretty theatrical. You see, he's got to sell it, and he puts on a show. That's what he did in the Raven. It's such a theatrical thing. See, it's really thick. Once he got internal rhyme. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. There's no way you can read that. You can't read it in a natural voice. The bleak piece of, I don't know whether I'm a villain or a hero. I'm getting into this. It was at the bleak piece of, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Short to borrow. He makes you do that with that internal rhyme. He gets to the point. And what the question in his mind is the same that was with his mind in Lydia. Will he see this sainted maiden ever again? Will they meet again? Here. Or in the, what does he call it? And so he asks those questions. You see, he flings a pillar out and states to that bird, and he imagines that the bird is a spirit that can answer those questions. actually what he'd done, just doctor it up. That same little feeling that he had in Lycia, he doctored it up with all that theatrical stuff, you see. It stands in the way, and hardly anybody who reads it has got the nerve to cut it out. Just cut it out. So our readers have to be pretty experienced to even stand it. If I can just watch someone cut it out. It's a hardy constitution. You know what it is, that pull, that attraction that Poe has. I just, it is. See, it's an Emersonian thing, not theatrical. I'd say there's an attraction to his spirit. I can't prove that. Do next time. The exam pretty well laid out so you'll know what to do. What? Yes, ma'am. You may change a little bit more someday. Isn't it nice? Isn't it nice to be able to change every now and then? You don't have to do check the same view all the time. It just depends on the handwriting. If I can read the handwriting, it doesn't matter at all. Sometimes they write kitty corners, and I have an awful lot. Has she got some handwriting in there?
Yeah, let me see if I can find some extra good for you. Because I was very careful when I wrote it, but I just, you know.
Is that good enough? Sure, I agree with that.
Did you pull it?
I had it out there right on my desk. And I had phone calls one thing or another, and I didn't get to look at it.
Okay.
Maybe I can next time.
Will Ben Franklin be on our desk?
Yeah.
You will?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
That's where they get the idea of prudence, you see, from the Franklin. And the idea of self-reliance.
Well, then we're going to have all the books and just essay questions. How about the DAB article?
I won't do
that. You mean you won't ask?
Oh, no. Well, that's your little questions to see that if I read it too.
Well, sir.
How long is it going to be?
Well, another 2 minutes or so.
Yeah. Would it be good in here?
Better, maybe. I've got a page in here upside down. This was by pure accident. I didn't really mean to confuse you.
You know, surprised at you.
I'm not happy with this. Come across. I didn't do what I wanted. I didn't accomplish what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did something. I'm unhappy about it, but I'll turn it anyway.
Do you want a guinea pig, Dr. Miles?
Yeah.
Off of my services. You want a guinea pig?
All right, I'll see if I can work up some.
All right. I mean, at this point, I'm so confused that I'm being built a guinea pig.
I missed the last clue. Here I am. Do I just let it go or write a paper or make it up or...
Well, you could write a little something on it. What was it about?
It was on the turn of the screw and I wrote a paper on it.
Yeah. You could do a little something on history.
History?
I mean,
the government. You know the thing of freedom and all these things? Dinsdale's freedom from his inner conflict and sin, and Hester's freedom from society's punishment.
Yeah.
The governance and freedom from Thoreau's freedom from society. They're all wanting to be released from something or other, be it you know, materialistic or from their mind. And Poe, you know, all of his being released.
Get outside of it. Freedom out of it, so they can see it.
There are questions for them. It's really, you know how you're saying, there was one thing that the governess always said in that book. She was trying to work it out. It was exactly what she said in class, but it sounded so familiar that she was, I mean, it was so conscious an effort on her part, though.
Yeah.
And the others, it wasn't conscious.
Not so sustained.
Yeah, well, it wasn't, I don't think, well, like Emerson was searching, Thoreau was searching, it was quite conscious type. I don't think Esther's was quite as conscious as the governess's was. The thing for me.
Hawthorne just doesn't allow her that much scope.
I mean, he constricts her?
Yeah.
He restricts her to it.
But that's, you see, that's what you say there is ample reason to look at it again. That's the beauty of it. You don't want what I say about it. You've already got the question open, see. What I say doesn't matter. You can just look at it yourself and see.
Thank you. Okay.
And that's the end of that pleasant little discussion. With me doing most of the discussion, on Wednesday of the last week, the 16th of March, 1969, and this is Channel 2 OPA, around 300. Around 300, Channel 2 OPA. The last week, the review, on Wednesday, the 16th of March, 1969. This is Channel 2 OPA, around 300. The Wednesday, the review week, the 16th of March, 1969. This Channel 2 OPA around 300, and this is a visit in the office with my friend Suzanne Lewis. I'm checking up. She came over to talk with me so I could see how she was thinking just before the big quiz on The Scarlet Letter and Emerson. I found out more than I ever knew on their mind at this juncture. This is Suzanne Lewis in the office on the last day of April, the 30th of April, Wednesday, 1969. On the last day of April, the 30th of April, 1969, on Wednesday. And this is a visit with Suzanne Lewis in the office. She came over after last class, and we sat and talked for a while.
I don't know. Things are starting, for some reason, to get a little clearer now.
Yeah. I mean, all your stuff, all your questions.
All of it?
You've got how much? You've got a half a dozen.
Well, I have metaphysical poetry, and that to me is, it's interesting, and I'm learning to find, you know, just analyze the poems myself. I don't feel too enthused about poetry. Just interesting to me. And I wrote the first paper, and I was scared to death about that paper. It's a 400-level course, and it's the first one I've had to write up here. And it's one of, you know, critical paper, 3 pages. But he gave me an A on it, surprising.
Who'd you write on?
I wrote on John Donne, 2 of his poems.
What'd you say about
him? Well, there were 2 poems, and one was called The Relic, and one was called The Funeral. And the basic thing was that the woman had left a bracelet of hair around the dead man's arm. And the first one, he starts out saying that this hair can act as his soul and hold all the parts of his body together and all this. And then right in the middle of the poem or down toward the end, he suddenly switches and realizes that she didn't do it because she loved him. She did it because she hated him and she wanted him to know about it. And the other poem was just practically the opposite. And it was two a man and a woman who loved each other and yet could never, you know, let it be known to society. And it was just the love of the mind.
Well, now, is that the is that that same mentality that Hawthorne admired in?
I don't think in those 2 poems in particular. No, those seem to me in a lighter tone. He wasn't that serious about it. But it still was the interplay of, I guess, Dr. Bryan called him this fantastic imagination that can change and view an experience from different viewpoints. And it doesn't necessarily have had to have an experience, but he can see it, or he has seen it, and he can express it and do it very well. And that, to me, was interesting. The fact that he could see one experience and see it in so many different ways in just two poems.
Yeah. And I see Hawthorne appreciated that, that mentality. And he attributes some of that to Hester.
I can't see it in Hester. Maybe, because, I don't know, she, I see, you know, that she's strong as she's supposed to be, I guess. But I just can't see her. She doesn't come alive to me, really. And I see what he's representing her to be, but I don't think she works out the way she's supposed to be. Because, I don't think, it seemed to me Hawthorne's not that sure himself what he wanted, because he makes her the person, the new world person who's aside from society and can yet exist alongside, you know, views it objectively as outside, not hampered by its boundaries and restrictions and modes of thought, but yet she sees it and I don't know. And then later on, but he says that this solitude that she's had and the conclusion she's reached about what she and Dimmesdale had done were wrong.
Are you talking about Carpenter's article?
No, I hadn't read Carpenter's. I was talking about
Father. Well, I called your attention to it.
Yeah.
Is that the passage you're thinking about? Yes.
About the shame and solitude leading her.
Yes.
But she's just not that clear to me. I see what she's supposed to be, but I...
Well, you see the direction of his story.
Yeah, right there.
And he does have the soul.
Yeah. But you see, I'm not that familiar with the mentality of the 17th century, except in the metaphysical poets, because I'm not that familiar with Milton. But I grasped the idea of this fantastic amount of knowledge that they have, just, and had a good grip on it, too.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, we take all the physical science and biology and stuff, but once we've had it, we forget it.
Yeah.
Generally, most of it. And we never retain it enough so that we could ever use it in something like that. And I see that. I mean, like, if that type of man were alive today, it'd be fantastic, it seems to me.
Yeah.
If he wasn't caught by the institution. But in this Victorian literature, and that, to me, ties right into the American literature. Newman and Carlyle.
I've never been able to see that. Talk about it.
Well, Newman particularly, and maybe not with Emerson, but the idea of his idea of a university. He's complaining at that time of the fact that the universities, they get such a smattering of all types of knowledge, all the sciences and stuff, and they never learn anything.
Yeah.
But they get a little bit of everything and never learn one thing completely. And I like it. I mean, it's so much of, just seems like he's talking about the universities of today. When you go into liberal arts and you have a year of humanities, a year of English, a year of math, a year of science, a year of physical science, but you never learn anything about it.
There's one, some of the tales help you in Hawthorne's thought. The man who, Ethan Brand, I guess it was, who went out in search of the unpardonable sin. And he was a lime burner, had a lime kiln. And I forget the details of it, but he searches and searches and searches. And he comes back to see it has refined his mentality. The search had done that. Now, I hadn't thought about those tales in Emersonian terms, but the search for the inquiry is the, that's a means. Well, there's so many terms in it, you know. But, see, Hester's close to that.
I just don't see her inquiring into anything, really. Except maybe it's her own relation. I guess she questions her relationship to society. I mean,
But it's nothing to me concrete yet that I could see her. I mean, I can see her as the potential there, but I don't really see her doing that. Except her decision that what they did wasn't that wrong.
That's something else. You see, you can't turn your back now on that whole little system of economy that Sarova adopted, and that she adopts. What's the difference?
Oh, yeah, the sufficient.
The subsistence. Now, you see, that subsistence economy was an ideal for good Lord knows how long. And it's still hard to beat.
Mm.
Now, that was a way of life. That's in question. Well, it does something. It's different. But now, you see, if it weren't for this, you forget how you'd regard her. You'd regard her just in such a superficial way. So you already, you see, that's, if you look at your paper here that day, and the terms in which you were saying over then and now, mm-hmm. You want me to give you a paper?
Yeah.
You see how far I actually have gone.
Yeah. I guess I have all this stuff going around in my head, and it's hard to get it straightened out.
Yeah.
Still. And it's hard to determine what's, well, useful or what's in it, you know, that really means something, rather than just, like you say, where's Damascus?
Yeah. You have to put in your gloss. You talking about
about a year or so ago. The teacher had a young couple teacher. And it's like every young Sunday school class, everybody sat there and it would not say one word, nothing. And except one or two would say something every once in a while just to keep it, keep it going a little bit. And yet I didn't like to say very much because I always felt like hogging the floor. And I hate that because I know how it upsets people. And that is, every once in a while, could actually talk about it.
Now look, Suzanne, you don't go anywhere where your mind works the way it does in these little sessions we have. And, the others that you spoke of. It doesn't do that at home. It doesn't do that with anybody you talk to. Now, in here, your mind doesn't work as well as it does in there.
I don't think it works at all sometimes.
Now, I'm putting thoughts, I'm putting words in your mouth. But that's my feeling. I told you that.
Mm.
Well, what are you going to do about it? Just go to school forever? You won't find, I don't find any substitute.
I like school. I just enjoy learning as such, I guess. I mean, because I'm finding out so many things. And the more I learn, or the more I read, the more I realize there's so much more to do. And I get a very frustrated feeling in school sometimes, and yet again I feel very satisfied in another time. I don't know, I'm not even that sure what I want from school. I know the reason I came to school was just because in high school there's always, in junior high you always had the prospect that in high school you get to take electives, you get to take what you want. So get to high school and take certain courses for your college prep, and that leaves maybe one or two electives that you could take. Those are rather limited. You could take those, and think, well, in college I'll get to take what I want to take. Get to college, and there's a set program for that, and take this, take that. And sometimes you find you like it. Like, I like science.
biology real well. I used to like history. So then I thought, well, when I get my major, I'll be able to take more subjects with what I want. But then I find out, well, you only take those subjects. You don't get a chance to take anything else. You know, it's really kind of frustrating.
Yeah. But you go home, and there's nothing there to interest you very long in time.
No, back when I worked this summer, I thought, well, I'll have, you know, since I'm just working, I'll have plenty of time to read and do what I want outside of work, but I didn't most of the time.
You've got to have.
I need the incentive of having to get something done and being in the atmosphere.
You've got to have the class.
Yeah.
It's
not subject to instruction, but provocation.
Yes. Now you see, the instruction, you can instruct yourself, but you're dependent for the other.
Yeah.
And it's not one, it's not a student on this end and Mark Hopkins on the other. It takes more than that. Half a dozen or a dozen. And you know, just for me to think that you were there and Roberta over there and the little learned boy, Mrs. Thing there, somehow it makes my mind work. And it just don't work easily. I don't know what it is, the New Jerusalem.
I don't know. I think I've always been afraid in classes to say anything wrong. And you get this pretty early, you know, that you learn to say what the teacher expects you to say.
Yeah.
And you get all frustrated when you say something and find out that's not what he wanted, and so now you've got to revise what you say. And I still haven't gotten out of that habit.
Sure.
And it's just, you know, and you're trying so hard to figure out what you're supposed to say that you don't have time to figure out what you want to say. Now, a lot of times what you want to say doesn't come out right.
You haven't said what you think you said. No. Well, now let's talk about that in a minute. Now, that's it. Now, let me tell you. You see, I've never had knowledge. I've told you that. Somebody asked me about Ms. Rawlings when she divorced her husband. And see, I won't even know she divorced her husband. But see, I live Ms. Rawlings. I mean, it's part of my life. But I don't have knowledge. Well, if somebody else starts a discussion, you see where it leads me. It's got to be in my terms. Well, I see in there it's not in your terms, but in a way it's terms we agree on.
Yeah.
And sort of work toward. Now, how is it? And you see, I would deny your direction a good part of the time. Something that you're interested in, see, I might carry along with you 5 minutes, but I wouldn't keep going.
Yeah, I noticed that.
but so you're still not your choice. Well, now, how do you figure that? You see, last, on that time, the Mark Twain thing, I didn't know where I was going, but we sort of zigzagged there together and came out with a very interesting thing. When I'm here, I know a little more where I'm going, but I set the pace. But it doesn't seem to you that I'm setting the pace altogether, does it?
No, not altogether. I can see it though when you change it. You know, when, like somebody asks something, it's like when they started the discussion on Thoreau's religion.
Yeah.
Well, I could see from reading that wasn't. Didn't even seem to be apparent in there to me, but it was something we associate with Thoreau as a transcendentalist, and so naturally think that it's in whatever he writes.
Yeah.
But I could see, you know, taking it away from that very definitely. But I don't feel as hampered, you know, like you're standing there telling us what to think. But sometimes I feel the need for a little more guidance. If anything, I feel need for more in your class than less.
Yeah.
And that's probably because what I'm used to.
Well, if you feel it, you can imagine how most of them feel it.
Yeah, I know.
Because you see so much more.
Well, I felt very bad with the first Corps. I had I'd get very frustrated because, you know, I kept feeling, well, we're at loose ends here, you know, nobody knows what's going on. but after a while, I could, you know, start seeing where we were going a little better, at least a little bit.
But in that, where everybody was good-natured, it didn't really work.
Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes it does. And maybe it depends on the people.
I think so. They were good-natured, weren't they? Several of them just made it that way. Now, the direction... Well, let me tell you about the direction. Now, you see, I can pursue this Emersonian thought, but if suppose I tell you all I know, what does that leave for you?
I think I can see sort of like knowing that we're going to end up with the turn of the screw. I can see where we're going,
yeah.
perhaps more than others do, because I, you know, had the turn of the screw before, and I.
Yeah.
So I can see that how the Emerson can be followed all the way through it,
yeah.
And provide the unity for all of us.
Yeah.
But some of the others you might not grasp, but this is what's going on. It's using him as to tie everything, or they don't see how he's going to be used further on.
You know, it's very hard to look at everything, isn't it? And now you see, look how many things there are to look at in there. You got to know Hawthorne and these little articles, and then you got to remember what you've been doing. And I don't see how anybody kind of can judge what's being done, really. Now, you see, one thing I have to guard against is making Emerson too important. It's just something that helps. But there are the other points of view. And you see, without this little book, I couldn't give them.
Yeah. I like these case books. You can see different things. And sometimes when you go into something, unless you have a lot of time to work with it yourself, you need some kind of help. You know, to kind of go on.
The direction.
Yeah.
You don't need much, just a little provocation. I wish I could sort of tell. I can't always tell. I can't tell. I give as much direction as I can without giving too much. Now you see Hester just in part, and you're impatient. That's the trouble with you. You see, I've already pointed out Denfail. Talk about Denfail.
Oh, I don't know about Denfail. This is a person, to me, who's just torn up inside. Because, you know, between what he is and the part of him that hasn't lived up to what he is. I don't know.
Well, that's the moral side of it. Looking at it from the Emersonian side.
Well, on that side, I kind of connect him to the Divinity School address. Because he has lived to some extent, well, then that's what makes him so, the other people be able to understand him so well. What makes him be able to talk to them rather than just preach.
Hawthorne didn't say that.
Yeah, he does. I mean, when he talks about how they feel the sympathy toward him.
But not for that reason.
I would think that's why. But they don't sense the sin in him.
You're rewriting it.
I'm kind of rewriting it from my viewpoint. they see him as perfectly pure, almost. I mean, the saint-like person. So they don't realize that he's...
Something gives him power. And it's not the morality of it. See, Hawthorne's not interested in morality. it's just fascinating. You see, what you do...
On election day, he says it's a spiritual uplift.
What?
The spiritual uplifting, yes. But, I don't know.
Who said that?
The Hawthorne. He talks about he's uplifted on a great wave. The inspiration which had held him up till he should have delivered the sacred message had brought its own strength along with it from heaven. And I think earlier,
now
its influence could be seen as it were descending on him and possessing him.
Now that's one of the poorest passages.
But I mean, this same influence doesn't work in all the other sermons that he gives that the people feel so meaningful. It's just this particular one.
You picked out one of them.
Most striking, anyway. I don't know. The part that maybe doesn't have that much to do with it, but I thought was kind of interesting was he stood at this moment on the very proudest eminence of superiority to which the gifts of intellect, rich lore, prevailing eloquence, and a reputation of widest sanctity could exalt a clergyman in New England's earliest day. When the professional character was of itself a lofty pedestal, I just thought that's kind of interesting.
Well, that's outside of him. That doesn't describe him.
I know. I guess we don't just think of ministers in that light anymore.
That's right.
Speakers and important people.
That just shows to what a height he did raise himself. I don't believe anyone realizes it's very, very difficult to realize just what a performance that was.
Anything so, it sounds like. Whatever he said.
Now you have no feel for Dimmesdale, do you?
No. Purely as Hawthorne, not even as Hawthorne says, but as the type of priest he was, our ministry was, you know, the where they talk about the three kinds, the stern kind, and the man who really has spiritually deep and yet doesn't have the ability to express it, and yet Dimmesdale was among these, but yet could express it. But
you're putting it in such prose and language.
Yes. There were others again, truly, true saintly fathers whose faculties had been elaborated by weary toil among their books, by patient thought and ethereal eyes, moreover by spiritual communications with the better world. And all that they lacked was the gift that descended upon the chosen disciples. And it was their ability to express this. But Dimmesdale has this.
Do not keep afraid.
Pentecost and tongues of flame, symbolizing what seemed not the power of speech and foreign and unknown God.
That's one of the high points of Western thought. You just buzz that straight. See, that's the Emersonian influence of a book.
That addressing the whole human brotherhood in the heart's native language. That?
Now I'm just catechizing you now, Susan. I didn't mean to do that.
That's what I was trying to say with Dimmesdale, that because he has experienced the depths and the heights of the spiritual being, then he has the ability to express it too. And that's why the people, I mean, that's why he can affect the people so much. Maybe not why they see him that way, but why he is so effective.
Now, the book says that Scarlet Letter has an intensity. Now, that passage would be one of the high points. That has an intensity about it.
Yeah, in that book doesn't come, you know, hit us very much. Is that we've lost the ability to think of in terms of oral expression. To me, you know, like we don't listen to great speakers. And language, oral language, doesn't mean that much. It doesn't affect us. We're used to written more so than anything else. Like, I can't ever remember hearing what to my mind would be a great speaker.
Yeah.
And so the that medium of talking, like Emerson used that, lectures, is totally alien to my experience. I mean, I'm just not used to it.
That's right. To read Emerson, you have to bear in mind all the time that was heard.
Yeah.
And it's written to be heard. Those things out. See, that's what I need. Somebody to remind me.
I don't think about it most of the time.
I think that's more important than most of the things I would say. Man. Just keep that uppermost.
To me, it seems like we've just lost the oral arts. The only minister, well, I guess a couple, one that I liked real well, but then another, the only one that stood out in my mind as a speaker, wasn't that much of a speaker, it's just that he was a professor of New Testament theology, and he was doing a series of what were for his class lectures, but he's doing them Wednesday nights in our church on apologetics. And I found it very interesting. Because I had to listen, and I had to listen very closely to follow him. And very seldom do we have to listen closely. You know, you sit there and listen, but you don't pay attention most of the time. It's like why I like to hear Shakespeare performed, that I have to sit up and really, the whole show, I have to listen to it instead of just relaxing and letting it run through my head. You have to pay attention to it.
No, I never, just never saw such a child. Her mind works partly because she's not under strain all the time. I used to be able to jump all the children. They just loved it. Maybe I could still do it if I had that feeling, you know, that when you go up to a bad dog or a mean horse, he knows you mean business. And it doesn't bother you. But they say those Western rattlers shy away now and don't stay and rattle. That's the way I feel most of the time. And that's this charming visit, the last day of April, Wednesday, the 30th of April, 1969, in the office. And this is Channel 2 over 785.